vib.no. Vib.no. Vi er på, ja. I Vib er vi stolte over å ha utviklet det som kanskje er verdens enkleste strømavtale. Den også en av markedets billigste spotprisavtaler. Sjekk ut vib.no. Det ikke noe mer å si enn det. Eller, ja, kanskje jeg kan legge til at det null påslag, og at du får alt på en faktura, og betaler kun 39 kroner I månedspris. Så da snakker vi plankekjøring, tenker jeg. Sjekk ut vib.no.
Okay, hi everyone, this is Ken Hensley, and you're listening to Jan Varka. And I hope that you have a great time. I hope you love it. I've enjoyed it very much.
God dagen, Helle Stenkløv heter jeg, og I mars traff jeg Ken Hensley, kjent fra blant annet The Gods, Uriah Heep og Blackfoot. Nå for tiden styrer han med soloprosjektet sitt, Ken Hensley og Live Fire, men siden Uriah Heep I landet I snakkende stund, skal det ikke høre hva sjølen sier om gamle og nye tider. Det her Jernverket, podcast episode 19.
And you've probably played your share of big stages and small stages anyway. You can play wherever you want now.
That's partially true. I have played, in a lot of different venues in a lot of different countries, and big and small and medium and everything. So yeah, I've done pretty much everything you would think that a rock musician would do, and had an incredible career. Now I play because I love to play, and I especially love to play with my band. I play lots of different kinds of concerts during the course of the year. This year, for example, I'll play a concert in Switzerland with a German symphony orchestra and a children's choir from Switzerland. I shall do 10 shows in Ukraine with a string quartet and some backing vocalists. So there's a lot of variety there. But, you know, I think I have enough experience where I can be flexible, and for me it's very enjoyable, you know, that I'm not doing always exactly the same thing. You know, I enjoy to play completely alone also, for a different reason. So, no, I'm lucky in that respect, very lucky, and enjoying myself a lot.
So we could start at the current date with the Live Fire band. How did you end up with those guys? How did you find them? And there are even Norwegians in the band.
Yes, there are. You make it sound so strange. No, there are. It's a fairly long story, but I cut it short. Back, I think, around 2006, I was invited to go and play at a small festival in Gressvik. And the idea was I would go there and I would play with a local band who would learn all my songs and blah, blah, blah. And this event would be called the Ken Hensley Summer Party. And so I went there, and it was in car park in the center of the small town, and there was about 200 people, and we had fun. So we said, okay, we'll do it every year. And then the following year I played with different musicians, and the first year I brought my own musicians from Spain, and then the following year they said, why don't you play with the local guys because they're really good? And so I did, and that worked very well. So we continued to do that. And this group of musicians evolved through changes until I came to a lineup of myself and four other players. And part of that lineup survives today, the drummer, Tom Arne Fosheim, and my guitar player, Ken Ingvesen, who is one of the best musicians I've ever worked with in my whole life. And then we had a singer from Iceland, and that kind of didn't work out too well. It's a shame, he has a good voice and everything, but he had some personal issues, and so we ended up with a bass player singer from Italy, Roberto Taranti. And so it's a quite a colourful little lineup, but it's compact, it's just the four of us. And but it's a very powerful band. So that's how this all came about. And they are my favorite people to work with. I don't like to work with other bands or pick up bands or anything like that. When there's a band show, I want it to be with these guys.
And let's go back in time. When did you know that you wanted to be a musician? You started playing guitar quite early. You were 11. Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't call it playing. I had my first guitar when I was 11. I had just seen Elvis on the telly, all these girls and everything. And I don't know, the idea of being a musician appealed to me strongly, maybe because there's music in my family, music in my blood. My mother's was a concert pianist, not professional, but extremely brilliant player. Dad was a good singer. So there was always music in the house and a lot going on. And so I think it subconsciously got into my head. And once I made up my mind this is what I wanted to do, then my football career kind of went to one side. I had a contract with an English professional football team when I was 16.
Which one?
Luton.
Okay, so you actually could have become a football player.
Well, in those days, they were in the first division. Now they're, I'm not sure, the 93rd division or something, because they didn't have me.
Yeah.
But so that kind of got shoved to one side, which pissed my dad off. And gradually, music became more and more important. And so the decision was quite quick and quite early, but the actual activation of that decision took quite some time, because I had to find people to play with, somewhere to live, a way to make money, a way to survive, and so on. And that was a long process.
Mm-hmm. How many years did it take before you felt that you could, okay, I can actually live from this. I can actually manage to pay my bills and still have some fun on the side.
A long time. Because in those days, when we're talking in like the 60s in England, pop music was the king. Guys with ties and short hair and everything. So for somebody like me who had ambitions to play American blues-based rock pop, there wasn't a lot of business. But I didn't care. I honestly can say that I didn't care. I lived in the van, so as far as bills were concerned, I just had to find something to eat and a place to shower every now and then. But my bandmates helped out with that. But it was determination. It was pure determination, and at the expense of everything else, family and everything. And until we got to the point in 67 where we made our first record.
The Gods.
Yeah. Mm. And so it began to pay off, and I could always see into the future a little bit. I could see a reason to keep going, and I didn't want to do anything else. I absolutely only wanted to play rock and roll. So it was going to take something enormous to move me from that position. So, like I said, you know, you sacrifice a lot. You have to accept that family and friends and all the normal things in life will go away and have to be sacrificed in order to focus on this one thing enough, with sufficient commitment. And I'm not talking about, you know, walking around expecting people to do things for you. I'm talking about doing what needs to be done. And so once I settled into that mindset, I just went for it 100%.
And now when you look back at it, you were one of those that helped create a completely new genre, with the progressive elements mixed with the blues and the rock and all that. At that time, you didn't know that you were actually creating something we would talk about today as a whole genre.
Right.
How do you remember how you worked and how you experimented at that time? That doesn't happen anymore. All genres, they are already there.
That's absolutely true, but there's kind of two or three questions in that one question. It really came about because after The Gods, we made two records, and it's reasonable to assume they were fairly ambitious records and quite progressive, actually. And they established several elements that would find their way into Uriah Heep, the heavy vibrato harmony and things like that. But funny enough, that band never really achieved its full potential. And so at the end of the day, I found myself back where I was, pretty much living in the van. The time when I realized I could make money and survive like a normal human being was when I joined the guys in Spice, and that became Uriah Heep, which was December of 69, actually. It was in January that we changed the name to Uriah Heep, but the management company was paying us a salary, £15 a week.
Wow.
Yeah, in those days it was a lot of money, but more than the money, it was some element of stability. I didn't have to look for anything else to do. I didn't have to go sell things on the market. I didn't have to go put up fences and all the things which I had done earlier. So now we had stability, energy, and the freedom to do whatever we wanted. And the post-Vietnam young people, that generation, just kind of basically adopted our rebellion. We did not sit down and say, we are going to create a new genre of music, because not one of us would have known what the word genre actually means. I know now, but then it's a French word, and we didn't speak French, so it was like, we didn't sit down and design this. What we did was we looked at what was popular, what was going on around us, and apart from The Who and the first traces of Led Zeppelin, there was just this sickening pop music. And so I think we took our influences and we just turned everything up to 11 and said, let's go for it. Grew our hair, wore outlandish clothes. Not really now, they're outlandish, but in those days they were. And all of a sudden this thing took off, developed a life of its own, and none of us knew what to do with it. The management, even the sound companies, they weren't making equipment big enough to handle the volume that we played at. So there was no infrastructure there to deal with this sudden powerful rebellion that was taking place between us and Sabbath and Purple and Moody Blues and all these bands, which just came along and said, you know, we're just going for it. And there was great camaraderie. And it's part of the reason why now so many young musicians ask me about that time. Because as you said, it cannot be repeated. All this genre-based stuff has developed to the point where it's mindless, and the industry completely controls the music.
It's like a prison in some ways.
In a sense, yeah, but still you have to volunteer to go in there. And you get occasional sparks of brightness and individuality, but it's very rare. And so many of my friends, good friends, great musicians from the 80s, Mike Portnoy, Billy Sheehan, and people like that, they always ask me about the 70s, just because they know it can't happen again. What was it like before AIDS? What was it like, you know, when you didn't have to have laminates and everything? What was it like? What was it like? You know, they just want to know how it felt. And organically, it felt so incredible. And to look back now, as you point out, to look back and understand that we were in the leading edge of something completely new and different, which would set the stage for so much more in the future, is amusing, confusing, but really thrilling. You know, to have the knowledge that I was part of that is great.
And you worked hard. You put out 13 albums in 10 years with Uriah Heep before you call it quits. Was it more, even more?
No, there was 10. I did 10 studio albums with the band, one live album, actually two, but one was fake. And then I did 3 solo albums. Yeah, we worked hard. It was unnecessary. We didn't have to work that hard. It was just the business was saying, okay, 10 months has gone now, we need a new album. And that means we need a new tour. And but we didn't care. Honestly, we didn't care either. We were just so happy doing what we were doing. We would have just kept running until we fell over. It was fun. And none of us, we didn't know how much money we were making. We knew we were getting big checks, you know, every now and then, or I was anyway, because I was writing all the songs. But, you know, we played Sell Out the Philadelphia Spectrum, and it's 20,000 people. I have no idea how much we got paid for that gig. Other guys from the band, survivors, will say they know, but I don't believe they do. This information was available, but we didn't bother asking for it because we were having too much fun. I know it seems crazy and irresponsible and everything else, but that's just how it was. We trusted the people that were managing our business, and that was a little bit of a mistake.
Mm-hmm. But what the Uriah Heep albums you participated on, which one is your favorite and which one is your least favorite?
Well, I've got... If I had to pick a favorite, I'd have to pick two. I'd have to pick the live album from 73, which is purely organic, and somehow it all worked out that night in Birmingham, and I can still listen to that album. Then the other one is Demons and Wizards, which is the point where I thought the band was at its absolute musical peak in terms of communication, in terms of focus and everything. Perhaps the most disappointing album, for a completely different reason, is the follow-up album, The Magician's Birthday, because I never really was allowed to finish writing it. I was in the middle of writing the album and a short story that went with it, and I got a call saying they moved all the release dates forward and we had to go in the studio sooner, and so the album for me wasn't finished, and I can't hear it because I know how good of an album it could have been but was not allowed to be. This was all part of the obsession within the industry for keeping the cash register fed.
But did you finish some of the songs later on, either in your head, or did you...
No, not really. I never revisited the whole thing. In fact, I've always been like that. I've always had a hard time turning backwards. I left that album with a lot of frustration, just thinking it could have been... I never finished a short story either. I was halfway through it. I could easily have finished it. And I'm sure the collectors would love it now if I did, but I'm not going to. Then the last album I did with the band, by which time I was so completely out to lunch, that was a very disappointing album. And so there were some down moments, absolutely some down moments, but... You know, I can't compare those down moments with how incredible the journey was up to that point.
Then you decided to leave Uriah Heep and do your third solo album. You moved, you got into more bands. Can you tell me about the 80s, the jump from Heep to completely another world?
By the time I left Uriah Heep in June of 1980... I left a band that sounded a bit like Uriah Heep but didn't feel like it. The problem for me was the chemistry had been destroyed when Gary died. Well, Gary was actually forced to leave the band before he died, but that broke the chemistry in the band, and it never felt the same after that. Then on top of that, we had David having become a total alcoholic, and that was another part of the chemistry, another part of the formula that was gone. So for me now, I wasn't in a band called Uriah Heep. I was in a band that was named Uriah Heep, but should not have held on to the name because it bore no relationship to the band that built up the illustrious reputation and became part of rock and roll history. Small part, but a part. So the last few years were difficult for me. At that point, I had turned to cocaine as a crutch. And so by the time I left the band, I was totally hooked on cocaine. I was completely lost. I didn't know who I was. I didn't know what I was going to do. Hell, I just knew I couldn't do that anymore. So after 10 and a half years, I just walked away. And I tried to do a solo thing. Free Spirit could have been a good album, but like I said, I was in bad physical and consequently mental shape at that time. And so it wasn't the album it could have been. It's not terrible, but, you know, I mean, it could have been better. Finally, after a year of fruitlessly trying to put a solo band together and everything else, I decided the only thing I could do was just go away completely, not run away, but escape, in a sense, from everything that was pulling me down. So I packed up and I moved to America. I already had a couple of homes there. I had an apartment and a cabin, and so I was perfectly at home there. And my objective was to kick my drug habit and find out who the hell I was. And I thought, a couple years and I can get back into business. So it took me nearly 16 years to find myself. It didn't take that long to get rid of my drug habit. That wasn't the hardest part. But finding a place for myself, who was I, what was I going to do? I knew what I had done, but I had absolutely no clue what I was going to do next. So it took a long time to find that.
But you still played during these years.
Yeah, well, I don't count the couple of years I spent with Blackfoot, because that was I don't know what that was. I think that was me trying to fill a gap, which was not fillable. And so this was a very unfulfilling time for me. Here's were a bunch of American Indians who played Southern rock, which is the most simplistic form of music. And I say that even in the face of the fact that country music is very simplistic too. But my style of playing and my thinking musically didn't fit in. So even after two albums and trying my best, I got the news that David had died. Mm. And I just said, no, I have to stop. And it wasn't until I found a job, a regular job. And I did that for 15 years. But during that time, I began to write again. This has always been my platform. Primary before everything else, I'm a writer. So I started to write again, and it wasn't very good, but, you know, I enjoyed it. And then I had an opportunity to buy a recording studio in St. Louis, where I was living at the time. And so now I did that, invested a little bit into the studio itself, and began to find ways to merge the studio with my new writing. And that enabled me to practice and to relearn my craft. So slowly but surely, during the 80s, I moved back towards writing. And then it was a matter then of finding a way to commercialize it or to capitalize it, make it a career. That was when the difficulties really came along, mm-hmm. because everything had changed so much.
Yeah, being 16 years away and thinking about the technology and artists and musicians that have come and left this world during those years. I don't know how to put this, but when you decided to come back, how did that happen? You'd been writing and preparing yourself, but how did you take that last step to get on track again?
Well, the first thing I had to do was move back to Europe, because I had lived 20 years in America it had served me very well. And I'll always be thankful for the part that living in America played in my rehabilitation. And then when I moved back to Europe, ostensibly because I wanted to be near my family again, that was when I began to see that, yes, I had a history, but it wasn't valid anymore. This was around 2000, the year 2000, that the industry had moved so far ahead of me, that technology, as you say, had moved so far ahead of me. The only thing I had to cling to, Hella, was the actual songs themselves, because that hasn't changed. The value of a good song or a great song is still there. And that starts with something as simple as this.
A pen.
And a piece of paper. So that technology, I was the master of that technology. So what I had to do was make my own industry, which was actually not quite as difficult as it sounds, because the internet had become so dominant and such an important feature. And I'm going back to the days of MySpace and things like that. I mean, that's how antiquated that seems now. But it did enable me to communicate and effectively expose my work. So I could write songs, go into the studio in Spain, and record those songs and sell them on the internet. So I was able to make a little money through my own industry, knowing that I would never get back into the mainstream industry. It's impossible for somebody like me, because, you know, by now it was like a machine. You know, it was just spitting out cornflakes and, you know, getting a new box of cornflakes. I mean, it didn't matter. There was nothing personal. And what happened during that time, I hope I'm answering your questions effectively here, but what happened during that time was I was learning all the time more and more how to write songs which I knew were good. And I had to write a lot of rubbish to get there, but I kept practicing, because now I had a way to finance this work through my internet sales and so on. I wrote my first book and so on and so forth. But it was a battle, and I guess it lasted 10 or 12 years before then I started to play live again. You know, there was so many things going on, and by 2006 I found the guys in Gressvik, and now we're here in Oslo, and so that's where we've come from, where I was.
What was your first book? Was that the memoirs?
No, it was an autobiography. It was called Blood on the Highway. It was part of a trilogy. I had a CD, a DVD, and my book, and they all came under the Blood on the Highway setting, story of a rock star's life in the 70s, basically. And the problem was, I was working with a company. It was a great company. They financed everything. But what they didn't know how to do was market or promote anything. And so it didn't really sell very well, but that's kind of okay. It sold enough to justify its existence and move me to the next thing. I'm halfway through my second book, which is much more honest and I think much more interesting. My first book was really, really trying. I was so still desperately trying to avoid only talking about music. I was talking about my family history, my school history, my hobby history, and everything else. But, you know, somebody pointed out to me, look, dude, whether you like it or not, your history is rock and roll, and you can't avoid it. You have to. You married it, and you're stuck with it.
You still are doing it, rock and roll.
Yes, I am, and still enjoying it thoroughly. I'm enjoying it a little more now, I think, because I don't take it as seriously as I used to, in terms of my life does not depend on it. Music is my life, and I will prepare as hard as anybody you know to make sure that tonight when I get on that stage, I'm ready. and I'm going to give people what they want. No one will work harder on that than me. To the point where people always ask me, why do you still practice? Why do you? And it's like they don't understand. Every show is different. I have to be prepared physically, musically, and mentally for every single show as if it was the first one. And then play it as if it was the last one. So this is part of what I said earlier, the professional dedication, the commitment. If you fail to practice, you are practicing to fail. And I know a lot of guys in my business that could have gone a lot further if they had been a bit more diligent. But I don't depend on it for a living. And so I enjoy it just that little bit more because I can kind of laugh and just say, you know, this is so cool. When I get up on stage tonight with the guys, it's going to be for me just so much fun, just because I will remember during the course of that 2-hour show everything I've done in the past. Little things will happen that will remind me of great things that happened in the past. And so it's much more than a concert to me.
Ja, nå nærmer vi oss 1. juli og stengingen av Ring 1-tunnelen I Oslo sentrum. Det betyr at alle bilister som kan må legge om rutinene sine. Se hvordan på veivesen.no/ring1.
Which songs, how do you pick songs for the shows? You say that every show is different, so I guess you also change the set lists.
Yeah.
Do you play songs from all of your career, or do you focus on your solo work in Heap?
Oh, no, no. it's an interesting question because me and the guys just spent 2 months going back and forth. I have a core set of songs which we always play. Songs like The Wizard, July Morning, Easy Living, Look at Yourself, Lady in Black, and then we have a lot of others to choose from. So we kicked some stuff around and we ended up with what I think is a pretty cool set list. It might be 2 hours long, I don't know, but that's not the issue. You know, I just leave this core group of songs and then wrap the others around it. And so that means that we don't play the same show all the time. It's different for me when I'm doing orchestral shows or solo concerts. That's a little different because then I have to choose the songs for which I have the orchestrations already written and so on. It's a much more scientific process. And of course there are songs like Easy Living. It's impossible to play Easy Living with an orchestra. It'd be silly. But songs like Circle of Hands are very effective with an orchestra and a choir. So yeah, it's pretty good. I did Circle of Hands, I did The Last Dance and July Morning with the NRK Symphony here in Oslo a number of years back, and this was quite an experience. This was really a great experience. They had a director who was from Wales. His name escapes me now, but he was a fantastic conductor. Merging a rock band and an orchestra is not the easiest thing in the world. But that's how I came to the set list, and sometimes people yell at me for stuff, you know, and we have to kind of be give each other a quick look and say, can we do this? And then sometimes we say no and do it anyway, you know, because there's nothing to lose. You know, what the heck? You give it a try and you screw up. And so, yeah, well, we tried.
Yeah, my sister told me to ask you, will there be any the God song since it's 50 years since the Genesis album now? But none of those, I guess, then.
No, we don't go back that far. If there was something there which jumped out at me or compelled itself to me to think of, I don't even think I included that. This is the album I just did with BMG.
Yeah.
It's the compilation album, which I compiled, not some troll that went and got the keys from the record company. And there's so many of those. But BMG allowed me to do this, so I went deeper into my archives not just for the music but also for the illustrations in the booklet, the very rare pictures that are in there. But I don't think I included anything in here. I went back as far as 1970.
Yeah.
With If I Had the Time, which got Paul Kossoff and Simon Kirk on it. And I'm very proud of that. It's a 8-track demo, but I'm proud of it because Paul and Simon played on it for me, and we were roommates at the time. And so I can listen to Paul Kossoff's guitar playing all day long. But no, the gods, no, we'll never go back that far. There's nothing there, as I say, within those two albums that says to me, you have to include this. This is an important part of your history. You have to do that. So, there.
But now we've had a brief history of time from your life, from the beginning to today. And we need some juicy stuff, too, for the listeners. Whether it's just a fun story you remember very well from some of your bands or time as a musician, a crazy one, a Spinal Tap-ish one, or maybe even a fan story of your own. Do you have something that you sometimes just pick up from your memory and laugh about, or just, whoa, did that really happen?
There is so much. Obviously, you know, you refer to it as a brief passage of time. It's not really. I mean, we covered a lot of years.
We did.
Yeah, and during those years, some crazy things did happen. There was a lot of fun stuff. There was a lot of sad stuff. Picking out little significant pieces is tough. But all of the negative stuff sadly revolves around alcohol. I remember when we sold out Philadelphia Spectrum, we had made this strategic decision, 1973, that for all our East Coast shows in America, we were going to base ourselves in New York, where we stayed in a really flash hotel, and commute. So we would drive from New York to Philadelphia, and instead of going back or going to a hotel in Philadelphia, we would just stay at the venue. And I remember very clearly the time when this was the first time David went on stage completely drunk, because the backstage area was full of all our stuff. And he just finished off a couple of bottles of bourbon before we went on stage, because there was nothing to do. This was a stupid mistake. We were just sitting around twiddling our thumbs after soundcheck. And the first thing happened was he walked on stage in darkness. We did the big dramatic, you know, epic dark thing, during which at one point Mick Box actually fell off the front of the stage and broke his wrist. This wasn't such a good idea, but, you know, it looked good. And David stepped on the foot of the microphone stand. It came back, hit him in the mouth, and split his lip, which started bleeding. This pissed him off. He was already drunk anyway. And he cursed the audience the whole rest of the night. And that was the night he began pissing his career down the toilet, and mine along with it. And it was in the middle of that tour that I decided to go home, that I wanted no further part of this. And, you know, audiences don't forget. Because the following year we went back to Philadelphia, minus David, and we just sold out the Fox Theatre, which is 3,000 people. So we went from a 20,000, sold out 20,000 seat show to a barely sold out 3,000 seat theatre. People really don't forget stuff like that, unfortunately. But we had to do some great. You got to remember, culturally, the world was a different place then too. I mean, we showed up in St. Louis, Missouri, and we wanted to have lunch, so we got off the plane, we got in the limos, we went downtown, we checked into the hotel, and the record company, the radio station people came and said, okay, we're going to go to lunch and then we'll go to the radio station. And that's cool. In those days, FM radio was really just a bunch of guys in a shack smoking dope and playing their favorite records for their friends. It was that pure. And so we went to this restaurant, which was in the top of the Gateway Arch. And I don't remember whether it was a particularly good restaurant or not, but it was a revolving restaurant.
Okay.
you know, Stouffer's Riverfront Hotel. And when we went up there with our manager, who was a perfectly straight English Jewish businessman, when we went up there, they wouldn't let us in. They would let him in, but we weren't allowed to go in because we, you know, we're just in our normal street clothes. And so Jerry said, okay, come on, we'll go down to my room. So we went down to his room and we all found like ties and some of his jackets and everything else. We went up there. I'm not kidding you. We looked like a bunch of clowns, but they let us in. No problem. It was just full of everyday things like that. And the fans were completely crazy. And the fans were everywhere. One time in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. No, it was Johnstown, Pennsylvania. After a show, David did his usual thing and invited the entire audience back to the hotel. And Johnstown's a small town, and there was only a couple of hotels in town then in those days, one of which was the Holiday Inn. And, well, would you believe it that they decided that they were going to actually all come back to the hotel? So by the time we got there, the rooftops, the swimming pool, everything was just full of these kids partying. And in the end, they had to call out the National Guard to get the thing under control. And we just went to our rooms and shut the doors and said, nothing to do with me. But, you know, it just shows you've got to be very careful what you say. Mm-hmm. But, no, it's really cool. Dragging out all the... I mean, I could probably talk forever about it because the more I think about it, the more stuff I remember, but there isn't time. This time, anyway. I had a girlfriend here in Oslo. I don't remember her name. And for some reason or other, we kind of broke up. And the following year, the band flew into the old Oslo airport, and I was pulled aside by customs out of everybody. And they put me in this little room with all my stuff, and they said that they had been told that I was dealing drugs, and specifically cocaine, and they were going to search everything to find it. And they said, you know, you can tell us now where it is and then it saves a lot of hassle. I said, I don't have any. It's not true. And for 4.5 hours, I sat in that little room while they went through everything, including my guitar strings, which they said were, these are needles. This is for putting the drugs in. I said, they're not needles. They're guitar strings, for crying out loud. Look in the guitar, you see. Anyway, apparently it was this girl. She decided that she didn't like me anymore, so she was going to report me to the authorities and make my life hell, and she did. I'm only telling you that because it happened here.
So, the ugliest way to break up with someone ever.
Well, I don't know about that, but it certainly didn't help to put the relationship back together, did it?
We also need some songs for the radio version. Usually I say 10 songs, but I actually want 18.
Highly unlikely that you'll get that, but I'll try it. let's go to the outside songs first, because I remember as a child, as a young musician, we played a lot of cover tunes because we, A, had not written enough of our own songs, and B, we had not recorded them or anything, so they weren't really relevant. And a song which will always remain in my heart for a number of reasons is You Keep Me Hanging On by Vanilla Fudge. Not Kim Wilde or whoever else recorded it. None of that. It was their version of that song blew me away. So in the Gods, we used to open our live show with that song. And later on, Timmy and Carmine, Tim Bogart and Carmine Appice, who were the rhythm section from Vanilla Fudge, they broke away from the band and formed a band called Cactus. And Cactus actually opened for Uriah Heep on some American shows. And I remember Timmy and Carmine always giving me a bad time because we stole this heavy vibrato vocal from their version of You Keep Me Hanging On. So it's not just a song that's a favorite song of mine and a favorite version of a favorite song, but it's also a song that has a real history and is really valid. I can go back also to My Generation, which was one of the songs I saw The Who play live in a small pub, and which I came away from that gig just so blown away. I said, these guys have the power, they have the message, and they don't care. And I like it. And then from there, I kind of graduated into Pink Floyd. And you can play anything from Pink Floyd because I love everything they did. Led Zeppelin, A Whole Lot of Love was a huge influence on me, not because I thought it was a particularly great song, but it was a fantastic production, an amazing, amazing production. And now we're starting to feel stereo actually come to life. And so I can always listen to that. It's very difficult for me to listen to, even though the Beatles were such great and such incredibly influential songwriters, I can't listen to a whole lot of what they did because now that George Martin's dead, I can't ask him the one question I want to ask him, which was, how much did you write from the Beatles songs? You know, like, And I Love You has a beautiful modulation, chord modulation in it to the solo. And I know that the Beatles didn't write that. I know that John and Paul didn't write that. You know, they're great musicians and everything, but this is such an orchestral modulation that it definitely must have come from George, but I can't ask him now. But as far as Uriah Heep songs are concerned, anything from Paradise and the Spell, Lady in Black is just such a mind-blowing song because it started out as a simple folk song, basically, which is why the band didn't want to record it. But it became an anthem in so many countries, and I'm still playing it 40-odd years later, which is a total shock. And then July Morning, it for me, the joy of playing that song is to look on people's faces when I play the intro, which is a simple, you know, triad. It's so simple, it's silly. But then I'm not that great of a musician, so everything I do is simple, and maybe that's the secret. Yeah, it remains effective because of that. Later Uriah Heep stuff is hard for me to deal with because it goes in parallel with the collapse of the band, and that's the thing. Those are things I really don't want to remember too much. But you know, from my solo work, well, again, I've included Guilty on my compilation album, and the main reason is because first, I think it's a good song, which I didn't perform very well. And secondly, because Barbara Streisand actually auditioned that song for one of her albums and came this close to recording it. That would have been cool. That would have been really, really, really cool. But, you know, I've got 350 songs in my catalogue, and so I guess I could make 20 or 30 of these without any difficulty. But there's a little sample for you. I hope that works.
Du har hørt et intervju med Ken Hensley utført for Jernverket våren 2018. Neste fredag slipper både Obliteration og Flight nye plater, og jeg har tenkt å snakke med begge bandene, så du gjør lurt I å abonnere på Jernverket podcast med det samme, enten via podcast-app eller på jernverket.com. I tillegg bør du følge med på Jernverket Instagram og Facebook. Nå kan du nemlig vinne månedens utgivelse fra Katakomben og den siste plata til Flight. Jeg heter Helle Stenkløv, og jeg gir deg en liten dose hardrock-magi med Jernverket hver fredag.
Ja, nå nærmer vi oss 1. juli og stengingen av Ring 1-tunnelen I Oslo sentrum. Det betyr at alle bilister som kan må legge om rutinene sine. Se hvordan på veivesen.no/ring1.